offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. And this is a program where we go through the verses of the Bhagavad Gita and try to understand them in depth. As always, I begin by expressing my heartfelt gratitude to Swami and the Swami and each one of you listeners, for without you, this opportunity would not have come my way. And there is so much learning in this whole process, and I think you all will agree with me that a casual reading of the Bhagavad Gita, at least I can speak for myself, would not have given me this opportunity to go in depth into some of these very, very profound, deep, subtle messages that Lord Krishna has given through this conversation with Arjuna. We are only in the third chapter, and that's not even one quarter of the Bhagavad Gita, but still there is so many beautiful learnings that we have picked up on the way, and I'm sure all of you will agree with me. We are in the beginning of the third chapter, and the third chapter is supposed to be the one on Karma Yoga. As we have seen, the second chapter itself is a concise summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita, but the statements that Krishna made in the second chapter are very cryptic. And so Arjuna asks for clarifications, and he says that you'll have to clarify this, you have to explain this more, and Krishna is much happy to oblige, and that makes us all happy, because otherwise we would not have had the opportunity to understand what he's saying in depth. And the other very beautiful thing is the references to some of the concepts which are spoken of in the Shrutis, or what we call the Vedas, are also very, very appropriate, and it also gives us an opportunity to understand those concepts in the context of a practical life, right? They are not merely rituals, they're not merely concepts meant for people who are into the reading and the chanting and the practice of the Vedas, but for all of us. And one of those concepts is what we are in the middle of. But before that, we'll start with a short summary of what we did last week. And in the course of that, the concept that I just mentioned will come. And a lot of that is going to be a part of today's episode as well. We went through only two verses last time, verse number 8 and 9 of the third chapter. And that was because I was explaining, or we were trying to understand, one particular important concept that Krishna was speaking, and which is going to be a central theme for the next 4 to 5 verses that are going to follow. In verse number 8, Krishna explained why action is superior to inaction. And in the course of that, he says that we all are in the society and we are placed precisely to perform certain tasks which are obligatory duties. He says niyatam, right? Niyatam is the word that Krishna uses, where it says these are your obligatory duties, because you've been placed in relation to someone in a position to the rest of the people in society. By virtue of being in that position, there are some actions which are mandatory, that have to be performed, which Swami described as kartavya karmas. Those are your duties and obligatory responsibilities that you have to perform. And because much of our action are such obligatory karmas, karma is always superior to akarma, or action is superior to inaction. In the same shloka, Krishna goes on to say that even if, say, you choose to give up all these obligations in the name of becoming a sannyasi, that's what a sannyasi means, that you kind of cut off all your relationship with all these people around you, which means you also negate the obligations that you have towards these various relationships. So even if one were to give up all these obligations by these means, or just say that you disown everybody and go, I mean, not in the modern context, not everybody who wants to escape from karma takes sannyasa. We just stop doing the karma. We just disown our parents. We just disown our siblings, or whatever that is. We kind of isolate ourselves from the obligatory duties. So Krishna says that even if you were to do something like that, run away from your obligatory duties, there still will be obligatory actions one has to perform towards one's own body. Krishna says even the upkeep of the body is not possible through inaction. So when that is the case, there is no question of one resorting to complete inaction at all. The idea of all this explanation being, how many actions can you really give up? If you choose to be inactive, there is no point in saying that I resort to inaction, because there will be some form of action, there will be some form of obligatory actions. So running away from karma is never a wise option. In the next verse, which is shloka number 9, Krishna says, it is true that all acts bind. And that is precisely the fear from which most of this conversation has come up. Because Arjuna is saying that, what if the actions bind me? So Krishna says that all actions certainly bind, except one kind of actions. Those are actions that are performed for the sake of a yajna. So this is where we went into a discussion on what is this concept of yajna. Because yajna is a word which is used for a very specific ritualistic form of worship, where oblations are offered into fire, incantations are made along with that, and there are certain things that have to be offered. There's a lot of procedure that is prescribed and followed for a yajna. And we've seen yajnas in Swami's presence, they're very elaborate affairs. So when Krishna says that only actions that are performed for a yajna are actions that don't bind, it goes without saying that when he says yajna, it refers to something much larger than just that specific ritualistic process. And that is why it was important for us to go into this understanding of what is really a yajna. And we dug into Swami's discourse, and there are three very important explanations that Swami gives. The first one being the Vedic declaration that yajna is God, yajna is Vishnu, which means that when you say perform your actions as an offering in a yajna, it means perform your actions as an offering to God. It is literally synonymous to that, and that is one of the explanations that Swami had given. The second explanation that we came across was where Swami explains the idea of sacrifice, and Swami puts it very simply by saying that even if you want to buy an object, even if you want to procure some substance, you let go of some money, you let go of some other form of savings that you have. So you always have to give up something to gain something. You always have to sacrifice something to receive something. And Swami was saying that when you talk of a yajna, and when you talk of yajna being a sacrifice, it means when you are ready to give up what is worldly in pursuit of what is spiritual, that is yajna. Right? So that is one of the very, very important explanations that Swami gave. So a true yajna is when the worldly is offered in pursuit of the spiritual. Something that Krishna had hinted at even earlier, because he was telling Arjuna that don't do karma for worldly benefits, don't do karma in pursuit of a place in heaven, but do karma with your vision fixed on the highest goal, which is moksha or liberation, right? So when Krishna says perform your actions as a yajna, it means do worldly actions, do whatever is your mandatory actions, but do it as an offering of the worldly and seeking the spiritual benefit as the only true reward. The third meaning of the yajna is the symbolism of the worship itself. The very fact that a yajna means sitting in front of a fire, a homokunda, what we call in Sanskrit, and then making these oblations or offerings, offering the ghee. And we actually even went through a beautiful passage where Swami says, what is the fire? What is the fuel that you pour into it? What is the grass that you offer into it? And which all means that this physical body with all the actions that is being performed is literally nothing but represented by a person sitting in front of the fire and performing this sacrifice. So that symbolism also has a very important meaning, and to put it in one word, it means that I perform actions, there are consequences for those actions, and those consequences are, I often want those consequences to be favorable to me, which means there are always consequences, but I have a desired result, and I'm always hoping that my desired result is matching with the consequences of the action, right? So this is the normal process, and when we talk of doing actions as a yajna, to put it in one sentence, I bring this concept of yajna in between my actions and the consequences, right? Where we say that what I do becomes the offering and what I receive becomes the prasadam. And of course, this is something that we'll keep repeating over and over again, because this is the central concept of Karma Yoga itself. And we will be going a little deeper into this symbolism of the yajna in today's shlokas too. So without much ado, let's begin with this week's verse. I think that's verse number 10. As always, we'll listen to it in Brother Shyam's voice. At the end of it, I'll give you a brief meaning of that shloka, and then we'll discuss and go in depth into what that shloka represents.
Saha yajna praja srishtva purovacha prajapatihi anena prasavishyadvam yeshavo svishtaka madhuk.
In the days of yore, having created the beings together with the yajnas, Prajapati said, "By this you multiply, let this be your wish-fulfilling cow." That's verse number 10 of chapter 3. Now that we've understood what a yajna is, or what is the approach to life it represents, I think we can see this particular shloka and the ones that are going to follow in the context of that understanding that we have gained. One of the most important Vedic hymns, and one that is chanted almost every day at Prashanti Nilayam, something that Swami has also extensively quoted in many of his discourses, is that of the Purusha Suktam. In fact, it is one of the most chanted suktams, you can say, even in many, many temples, in many, many religious functions and rites which are performed in many parts of the world. I think it still is very, very regularly chanted, and it's a very beautiful and very profound verse. Of course, I'm not going to go into the detailed meaning of this mantra, because one, I know very little and I need to do a lot more reading before I'm able to speak about what the Purusha Suktam represents, but definitely it would be a wonderful exercise to do that at some point in time. The other reason why I'm not going to go into the complete detail of that is the verse is very profound, and it speaks of many, many symbols and subtle points which is not does not fit into the scope of the discussion that we are having today. So let's just take the part which is relevant. The central concept of the Purusha Suktam is that of a performance of a yajna. It describes a yajna which is in progress. And this is not any ordinary yajna. This is a Purusha Yajna. And that's where the name for the Suktam comes, Purusha Suktam. It is a Purusha Yajna where the Lord, who is referred to as Purusha, he is himself being sacrificed. He is the sacrificial offering in the yajna. Though the idea seems a little weird, we will see how that's a very, very profound thought. So who is doing this yajna? Who is performing this yajna? It says that the pure beings, or the devatas that were created by the Purusha even before he creates the rest of the creation, and especially human beings and other sentient beings, the devas or the devatas, the most pure beings, are created, and these pure beings are performing this yajna. So the Purusha Suktam describes how these devas, who represent the various aspects of nature, and they were created by the Lord for taking care of all of these aspects, and these devas come together and perform this grand yajna where the Purusha is the sacrificial offering. And there is this very important part that says, from his head was born the Brahmins who will dedicate themselves to knowledge, and from his arms come the Kshatriyas who will dedicate themselves to the protection of society. Right? That's a verse which Swami has quoted many, many times. Krishna, in this particular verse, the verse number 10 of chapter 3, I think is speaking about the concept of yajna. And he is referring to this particular yajna which even the Purusha Suktam speaks about. Krishna says, Puraha, in the beginning, Prajapati, the Lord of the universe. Prajapati is more precisely translated as the Lord of all the subjects. Praja means subjects. So he says, Puraha, in the beginning, Prajapati, the Lord of the universe, Saha Yajnaha, through Yajna. I'm saying through Yajna because I'm making a reference to the Purusha Suktam, but Saha Yajnaha literally means along with the process of Yajna, along with Yajna, not necessarily through Yajna. We will see how it is through as well as along with Yajna. He says, Puraha Prajapatihi, Saha Yajnaha, through Yajna, Prajaha Srishtva, having created the people, Uvacha, he said. So he says the Lord Prajapati created the Praja along with Yajna, and then he said, what did he say? We'll come to that in a short bit. But the point I'm making is this line represents the Yajna, which is described in the Purusha Suktam, and there are some important points that we can pick from there, and that is why the reference I'm making to Purusha Suktam is important in this point. In that, in Purusha Suktam, it is described at length as to how there was actually no means to perform a yajna. There were no material objects, right? When we talk of a yajna today, we talk of the ghee being the fuel which needs to be poured into the fire. We are talking about firewood. We are talking of the various grains which will be offered into all of that. When we are talking of a time when the Lord has just created the most pure beings who are going to be like the deities who will be managing the various forces of nature, we do not have the concept of a cow and a cow giving milk and the milk giving ghee, right? So there is none of these objects. We don't have firewood. We don't have any of these objects that are spoken about. That being the case, the yajna that is being described becomes a very subtle process, a mental process, what we refer to in Indian tradition as a manasa puja, a form of worship which is purely done mentally, right? A puja or a worship always involves some kind of physical action. You offer aarti, you do different kind of things, you do a sandhya vandana, you do archana and all of that. But when we say a manasa puja, it means a form of worship which is completely done mentally, right? So in that sense, this yajna which is being spoken of in the Purusha Suktam is a manasa puja, or something which is done purely in the mental state. So when Krishna said only actions that are meant for a yajna do not bind, I think this is a reiteration that when any action is performed with that mental attitude of a yajna, they do not bind, right? So this yajna that Purusha Suktam speaks of is not a physical yajna, and when Krishna is speaking here of the yajna which was given in the beginning, I think this is a connection that we can make, and I don't think we would be wrong in doing that. The second point is, it is said that they did not perform the yajna because they wanted to or they were expecting something at the end of yajna. This again is the reference to the Purusha Suktam, right? They performed the yajna because they were mandated to. They were created by the Prajapati and they were given this task of performing the yajna. So the yajna was performed not with a desire, but was performed as a duty. And when it says the sacrificial offering was God and the results were also nothing but God in different forms, it speaks of the approach towards our efforts and the results. What I offer is also divine. What I receive as results, whether I like it or not, is also divine. Right? So that is what it represents, the Purusha Suktam, as it beautifully describes all of these processes. And Krishna also says, the whole process was produced through this yajna where everything was pure. The beings that performed the yajna were pure. The attitude was pure and the whole process was perfect. And such a yajna does not bind. And having orchestrated such a yajna, the Lord gifted this process to creation, right? The Lord did not have to create the world through a process like this, but he chose to do it this way so that the process not only remains a means of creation, but also becomes an example that is given to creation, right? So just to gift this process of doing and accomplishing anything, the Lord chooses to create the world through a yajna, right? And that's why the Purusha Suktam is also supposed to be a suktam where it is spoken of how creation came to be and how everything is divine, how every caste that we see and every being that we see, every sentient and insentient being that we see are all divine because the Lord did not create the world, but the Lord, a part of the divine being, became the creation, right? That's one of the most important concepts in Sanatana Dharma. So he says that just to gift this process of how you perform a yajna, with what attitude this entire creation happened in this manner. So Krishna says, Saha yajnaha prajaha srishtva puraha uvacha prajapatihi. Having created the prajas along with the yajnas, the prajapati said, what did he say? Uvacha. Krishna says that after having done it this way, the prajapati speaks and he gives this command. He says, anena, through this, which is a reference to the process called yajna, anena prasavishyadvam, may you multiply or may you prosper. Esha, let this, which is again a reference to the yajna, vaha astu, be for you kamadhuka, the wish fulfilling cow. So Krishna says the approach of yajna was gifted by God to man and said, use this process to fulfill all your wishes. God doesn't say give up everything and you should not enjoy anything, but he says that whatever you want to achieve, pursue it, but use this process as a means for fulfilling all your desires. And this is the essence of the section on the yajna, the 4 or 5 verses that we're going to go through in chapter number 3. But maybe before we speak in detail about what this really means, what is Krishna referring to, we'll probably listen to the next shloka. And there are some points in the next shloka which are very, very important and which is connected to this shloka. We'll maybe listen to that and I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And then we'll understand what it means when Krishna says that Prajapati gifted this process and said that fulfill all your wishes, but fulfill it through this process. He says, by this yajna, may you multiply and prosper. Let this be your wish-fulfilling cow. So we listen to verse number 11 and then we will discuss further.
Devan bhavayatanena te deva bhavayantu vaha parasparam bhavayantaha shreyah paramavapsyata.
You nourish the gods with this. Let those gods nourish you. Nourishing one and another, you shall attain the supreme good. So as a continuation of what Krishna said previously, that let this process of yajna fulfill all your wishes, he says, anena, with this, devan bhavayata, propitiate the gods or the devas. Te deva bhavayantu vaha. Then the devas will propitiate you. So the question comes, now where did the devas come from now? Till now we were talking about offering our actions to God. Well, still the reference is to God, but we look at every aspect of nature through which we have to gain something as represented by a deity. If we want rains, we propitiate a deity who is representative of that particular force of nature. If I'm a goldsmith and my entire profession depends on the fire, I pray to the fire, which is a source of my livelihood, by considering fire as a deity. So the farmer similarly celebrates the sun because that's central to his prosperity, right? So going back to the yajna performed by the devas, it is not that God will bless or do his work only if praised, right? We're talking about the primordial yajna. So did the devas perform the yajna to please God, and only when God is pleased he's going to do what he's supposed to do? Well, God is not a boss or a government officer who seeks such kind of petty joys in life. He will anyway do what has to be done. Similarly, when it comes to you and me, we also have to do what we have to do. But as we saw the last week, through this process of offering or sacrificing, we are making an attempt to disconnect our actions from the results. If you look at it in life, when we strive to achieve anything, there's always a huge component that is beyond us, right? That's something that we've mentioned many times before also. In fact, I had once spoken about it in one of the earlier talks or one of the programs. I'm sure I must have played it in one of these segments. There is a concept called Rube Goldberg machine. It's a setup of very simple mechanical steps where one step triggers the other and that step triggers further steps. And, you know, it eventually, it's a whole setup which the final thing is a small thing, but it involves many, many mechanical steps. Something similar to a domino effect, but using a number of simple mechanical instruments. I think you must have seen something like that. You know, a ball will go rolling and it'll push something and that'll fall on a platform and that'll trigger a lever and that'll move something. That's something similar to that. This kind of a setup is referred to as a Rube Goldberg machine. If we were to look at our own lives, it's very similar to something like that. Whatever we are at this point in time, at the age of 35 or 40 or 50 or 60 or at the time of retirement, if we look at it, many of the stages that we have come through, one has led to the other and one has been instrumental in us doing the next step. It's almost like this Rube Goldberg mechanism where you had this number of steps which created a domino effect which has made us where we are today. The reason why I'm referring to this mechanism is I saw this video where this person was talking about the Rube Goldberg machine and he was talking about the numbers involved in the sense of probability when we're looking at a machine like this. So he shows a setup where there's a typical Rube Goldberg setup which has 130 interactions, right? And that's quite a bit, where you have 130 steps, one leading to the other. And then when he puts up this whole thing and he says, now for this whole setup to work, each one of these steps have to work, right? That's simple to understand. So he says that if each one of these steps are accurate to 99%, right? 99% accuracy is a lot. If we are sure, 99% sure of something, we'll definitely do it, right? That's what he says. If you're going to take up some task and the probability of you succeeding is 99%, most of the time we'll close our eyes and do it because that's a very, very high probability. So he was saying that if each of the steps have a 99% accuracy, a 130-step process has an overall accuracy of just 27%, right? It's amazing. It's just 27%, which means if I have a setup with 130 steps leading to the final step, if I am sure that each of the steps will work 99% right, the chances of the whole setup working is almost 1 in 4, just 27%, which is very, very less. Imagine you wish to become a doctor or you want to become a very successful lawyer or whatever it is. Our life is like that, you know, there is a primary schooling, higher secondary school, and then you have your junior college and all of these things. It is almost like different steps of a Rube Goldberg mechanism. And imagine in each one of these steps, your success rate is 99%, and that's huge, right? I don't think any of us have come through life with such success rate, right? Imagine your success rate in each step is 99%. Then the chances of you becoming a doctor or a lawyer is 25%. But still, say we have become a doctor or a lawyer and somebody comes and asks, so how did you become successful? What would we say? Oh, I was brilliant all through my academics. I was always good at academics. I always got 99%, right? But we don't realize that the chances of us making the final cut is still such a slender chance. Right. In fact, he goes on to say that, forget about 99%. Let's bring down the percentage a little. Let's say 90%, right? 90% is also a huge figure for most of us. You know, if I was to clear each of my schooling years with 90%, then I would be on the top of the world, isn't it? So he says a 130-step Rube Goldberg machine, which has 90% efficiency at each step, the overall efficiency of the system, he says it has a success rate of 1 in a million, right? And I hope you get the gravity of this thing, 1 in a million. So if I'm a person who has always been on 90%, I mean, I'm just rephrasing this whole thing to give the idea, but I know that it is not exactly in that manner. But I'm just putting it like this. Let's say that I'm a person who's always been scoring 90% and always, I'm a person who's been clearing everything with distinction. And at the end of it, I achieve my goal and I become a doctor, an engineer, or a lawyer, or a chartered accountant, or whatever it is. Still, my chances of making that cut was 1 in a million. But yet, we look back and say, I achieved it. I did my actions right, and I did my exams right, and I achieved it. The fact is, we make our efforts, and we get results which certainly are not correlated to the actions, right? The success that we see in life is certainly not relatable to the action that we put in. There is an enormous aspect which is given up to chance, right? So by thinking that I worked hard, I did my karma, and therefore I am here, is not only factually incorrect, but it will also lead to a very, very strong idea of doership. And it is that doership that binds, right? When we say action binds, it is that sense of doership that binds. That's something which we've been repeating so many times. It is doership which leads to enjoyership, and that is what binds, right? So when we look at something like this, this whole process, what we refer to as a yajna, has been suggested in the Vedas and is being emphasized here by Krishna. It's a means by which we acknowledge that I do what I can and I offer to God, and what He gives is certainly not commensurate to my action, but is an expression of His grace. And this acknowledgement is what is a yajna, right? And you can see that it is not factually incorrect. It is true, whatever we are today. If I am sitting here and able to speak in a language, or if I am able to put my thoughts together in a coherent form and communicate, there are hundreds and hundreds of steps involved in it, in which so many people have contributed, in which each of these steps, even if they had 99% chance, the chance of me sitting here and doing what I'm able to do is so much not dependent on only my actions, right? So this process of yajna is a means by which we acknowledge that. So this process which Krishna is speaking about as yajna, which was gifted by Prajapati to the prajas, all the subjects, as a means for achieving whatever they want to achieve, involves two concepts or two principles which are very, very central to the Bharatiya culture itself. And when I say Bharatiya culture, it is not a reference to a place which is geographical, which Swami would often say. A Bharatiya lifestyle or a Bharatiya culture is always a spiritual lifestyle, right? So there are two concepts which the yajna represents, which is very, very central to the spiritual lifestyle. So what are those two central ways of life? First is a duty-centric life. I think this is a point I've mentioned many, many times in the course of answers that we've done as part of the answering booth, that this is an attitude shift that we all have to bring into our lives, because a spiritual life is not a rights-centric life, but it's a duty-centric life. An individual must always ask, what is my role? What is my duty in this particular situation and circumstance? What am I supposed to do? Not what can I get out of this, or what should I do to receive the best for me, but what am I supposed to do given this circumstance that I have been put in? And that is what Krishna had said in the beginning itself. We had discussed extensively last time about this particular phrase, Niyatam Kuru Karma Tvam. Do what you are supposed to do, right? And this is about the roles that each of us play in society with respect to others. What we are due to do, as I mentioned last time, what we are due to do is what is our duty. But this also holds good when we have desires and ambitions as well, right? And I'm sure some of these concepts are quite repetitive, and those of you who are listening every week will be thinking that, oh, this This guy seems to be repeating it every time, but right, that's the most important thing, and there's no better way than repeating it to ourselves over and over again and ensuring that it becomes a part of our thinking mechanism, right? For instance, let's say you're a father, you're the main breadwinner of the family, right? So your duty is to take care of the family, your duty is to earn and provide for the family. But you might also have an ambition that I want to be a very successful businessman. So there is a duty, but there is also a preference how you want to perform that duty, right? A father might want to be an artist and perform. A father might want to be a businessman and perform. A father might want to be a regular person working in the corporate world for a salary and perform the same thing, right? So even duty gets modified by one's preferences or one's raga and dvesha. So when we speak of duty, it means from what you are due to do based on your stage in life and from what you choose to achieve in life through these two, broadly speaking, these two principles, you define what is your dharma or what is your mandatory action that you have to do. And to lead life by constantly seeking this question of what is my duty and responsibility and not focusing on entitlements or rights, Swami says, is a very, very important aspect of spiritual life. In fact, Swami would say that this is, Swami would say this to the students when he's speaking to them, that one of the motives of my university is to teach you all to lead a duty-centric life, right? That's what Swami would say. In fact, the other day when we were talking to one of the professors from Swami's university, Professor Gangadhar Shastri, who still teaches in the campus here, and he was also the director of the campus formerly. So he was telling in the initial years, he did not come to Prashanthi Nilayam as a devotee. He just got to know that there's a vacancy in a new college here, and that's how he came and landed here. And eventually, slowly, he became a devotee, and Swami was very fond of him. Swami would give him very, very important assignments. And I mean, that's a very beautiful story, how he transformed from being a youngster who came to be a lecturer here and then eventually became a devotee. And today he's an inspiration for all of us, right? So he was telling that he's a professor of political science, and one day he was taking class for Swami's students. And those days Swami would very often walk into the campus and walk up and down the corridor and sometimes drop into any class and see what class is going on. So he was taking this class for his on political science when suddenly he saw that Swami came and stood at the door. And, you know, he had a different kind of way to interact with Swami because he did not look at Swami as a guru or as his God. So he looked at Swami and said, "Would you like to come inside?" And very typically of him said, "Would you like to come inside and sit?" And Swami said, no, you take your class, I'll stand here and observe. I said, okay, well, you can stand there. And he continued with this class, which is something which is unthinkable of, you know, it's so difficult to speak when Swami is standing next to you and here is Swami standing at the door and you're taking a class. And on that particular day, I think he was taking a class on, I think, liberty. That's one of the most common concepts in political science, right? Rights and liberties and all of that. So he was teaching about this particular class, and then Swami stopped him and Swami said, "See, when you teach my students, emphasize more on responsibilities and emphasize less on rights. I want that they should lead duty-centric lives," right? So Swami was very, very particular about this because it's a central idea of a spiritual life itself, a duty-centric life. So that is one point that defines a spiritual life, which comes from this idea of a yajna. What is the second aspect? When you acknowledge that what you receive is not purely a result of your action, there is always a sense of gratitude, right? When a farmer starts off the agricultural process, let's say, you know, first he does what he is supposed to do, be it tilling or plowing, or sowing the seeds, and whatever the process is involved. And after having done what he is supposed to do, what are his defined actions, then he propitiates the gods of the rains. As Krishna said in this verse, Devan Bhavayata, propitiate the gods. Then when the rains come and the farmer has a bountiful harvest, he feels a sense of gratitude. He acknowledges that the results he sees is not purely a result of his own actions. So Swami has said this any number of times, that even if a strange person comes and picks up a handkerchief that you've dropped and gives it to you, you say thank you, right? But how often do we thank God for the bounties that we've seen in life? How often do we thank God for the things that have gone right in our life? The moment something goes wrong, we remember God and say that, God, why did you let this happen? But how many things happen right in your life? If you have to be alive from the time you wake up and the time you go to bed, do we realize how many, I don't know if there is a term for that, or how many ounces of grace, or how much quantity of grace from God is required for us to get us through even one full day, right? So Swami says, do you express gratitude for that, right? So the sense of gratitude, even as we go through life, and the gratitude for the smallest to the largest event or the object or the success that we see in life, is another aspect of a spiritual life. And this becomes easy for a common man when he personifies the forces of nature into divine beings or deities. Because once he does that, we can feel a sense of kinship, and gratitude becomes very, very easy, right? When you think that, oh, I'm praying to the God of the rains, and the God of rains has responded, or I am having this and I am very grateful to the gods, right? That feeling of gratitude and kinship, and I am offering it to this person, becomes easy in that sense. And this will also lead to one having a sense of responsibility towards nature, and that's one other very, very important point. It is not merely a cold transaction at a counter that I have done, I have received, right? Like if you walk into any a service provider or something, we always have this attitude. I am paying and I am taking the thing. I mean, there is no necessity for me to be cordial, or there is no necessity for me to, go overboard and say thank you and, you know, you're very kind of you. We make it, our transactions become very, very cold when we look at something as an entitlement, right? That's what happens to most of us. But when we build a relationship, say, with a shopkeeper, the way we will interact with that person will be completely different, right? So instead of creating goals, working hard and achieving them and gloating over ourselves or not achieving them and blaming ourselves, can we define our swadharma based on our obligations, which are niyata karma, and our own preferences, raga and dvesha, then do our duty or play our part, then pray to God and say, I have done my bit, I am offering it to you, and then accept whatever comes as grace. So when one constantly does his actions this way, as Krishna said in the second chapter, there is no waste of effort in karma yoga, isn't it? Because this process always cleanses the mind. One may or may not receive what one has set his eyes upon, but it will always lead to the cleansing of the mind or the achievement of Chitta Shuddhi, which of course eventually makes one eligible for jnana. That's what Krishna says in the second line of the shloka. He says, parasparam bhavayantaha. When you mutually please each other thus. In the previous line he said, you please the gods and let the gods please you. Right? So he says, parasparam bhavayantaha. When you mutually please each other in this manner, Shreyaha Param, the highest good or moksha, Shreyaha Param avapyasyata, will be gained by you. Right? So by this process, whatever we've described as yajna and how one has to do and one has to receive, it is not about just receiving those benefits of your actions, but Shreyaha Param, the highest good, can be gained. There's one more aspect I would like to touch upon before we move ahead in this particular chapter. We spoke of dharma as in duty, but where does dharma as in morality or righteousness fit into all of this? Can I indulge in unrighteous means and then I say I offer it to God and accept what I get as prasadam? Is that a right means or right approach? Excuse me. This whole process of yajna is, if you look at it, is about a balance that comes from mutual respect, right? Parasparam bhavayantaha. That term refers to a mutual respect or a mutual codependence or a coexistence. It talks of something like that. So when it's something like a symbiotic relationship, I think we've studied so often in biology and ecology, right? In a way, since this respect and reverence for nature has reduced in the modern way we live, and luckily through activism now it is coming back, right? What was done as a religious means in the past is now coming back as activism. But sometime in the middle, we completely lost it. We looked at worshipping deities or worshipping nature as a form of paganism, and we kind of lost our way a little bit in that. If you look at it, this loss of reverence for nature is what has led to the balance being disrupted, isn't it? Swami would say, if you look at the animals would hardly overeat. And even if they overeat, they will not have this habit of hoarding for the future, which we are so very good at, right? And that's the cause of the problem. Somebody might need only a small bit, but there's always this thing of hoarding much, much more than we want. And that leads to greed. And that is what has led to this whole balance being disrupted. So in a sense, this righteous living or living within limits is inbuilt in animals. So there is no greed or revenge or there's no any of those emotions that we talk of which makes the balance, which disrupts the balance in human life, is not there in animals. But at the same time, if you look at the animals, there is no conscious selflessness or conscious self-sacrifice, right? There is no animal which will say that I will sacrifice this for a higher good, or I will sacrifice this and receive something spiritual, or I refrain to do this action. This very conversation comes from Arjuna, who says that I don't want to fight, I want to become a sannyasi. There is no concept of sannyasa in the animals. There is no concept of I choose to do this and I don't choose to do that, right? The reason why I am talking about the animals and I'm talking about man, where does righteous living fit into all of this? In the animals, a moral living or a righteous living, which leads to a balance between nature and the beings, is programmed into the animals. So in that sense, are we any lesser than the animals? Not necessarily. I'm going to give you an analogy which I think might explain this a little better. Let's say today I want to go to Bangalore. The thing I have to do is I'll have to go to the bus stand. I'll have to look for the bus. I'll get into the bus and I will eventually reach Bangalore. But I have a very, very limited choice once I get into the bus. Right? I will have to put up with wherever the bus stops. I will put up with where the bus stops for lunch or breakfast or whatever it is. And I do not have control over what time I will reach my destination. That depends on how long the bus is going to take. So when we talk about an animal life, everything is programmed. It is something similar to somebody sitting in the bus. But let us say that I want to get ahead of the traffic and I have this thing that I want to reach Bangalore in say 2.5 hours, or I want the control such that if there is less traffic, I want to get earlier, or I want to go slower. I just want to enjoy the ride, right? So when we talk of that, it is like a person who probably takes his own car or he's going to drive down Bangalore himself. So you are taking yourself out of this program ride and you are taking the ride yourself. And when that happens, it does give you a freedom nevertheless. But along with that freedom, now the rules and regulations that go with driving on the road become your headache, right? When you're sitting in the bus, you don't have to worry about that because the whole thing is programmed into the ride. The driver is going to think about that. So that is something like an animal life where everything is programmed. The animal will not disrupt the forces of nature, will not disrupt this balance. But man who wants to progress ahead is given a free will. But the free will, one part of it, has to be used in maintaining that morality or righteousness in life. which is otherwise programmed in animals, and along with this programmed righteousness, man also has the opportunity to surge ahead, right? So when we ask this question of, you know, where does morality fit into it, morality is literally not spoken about anywhere here, because it is a given. One has to lead a moral life. There's no question about that. And that is, I think, one more reason why the reference to yajna, why couldn't have Krishna said that, oh, you know, do it as an offering and do it this way? Why is the reference to a yajna? Because again, yajna represents a ritualistic process. And along with, when you say a ritualistic process, it comes with, a lot of rules to be followed, things to be done, right? So automatically the idea of a certain kind of life gets into it. You kind of turn back to, the Vedas and look for, if I'm a teacher, how am I supposed to live? If I'm a king, if I'm a ruler, if I'm a head of state, how am I supposed to live? Right? So the moral life is a given. It is not spoken as much in these verses, because it is understood that that is the bare minimum for somebody to surge ahead. So I thought I'll just make that point here. So whenever we speak about dharma, it not only means about mandatory duty, but it also means a moral form of life. I think we have a little more time. We'll go to the next verse. We'll discuss as much as possible, and then we'll take it forward after that from next week. This is verse number 12 of chapter 3. We'll listen to the verse in Brother Shyam's voice, and then we'll discuss about it.
इष्टान् भोगान् हि वो देवा दास्यन्ते यज्ञभाविताः तैर्दत्तान् प्रदायैभ्यो यो भुङ्क्तेस्तेन एव सः.
Being nourished by sacrifices, the gods will indeed give you the coveted enjoyments. He is certainly a thief who enjoys what have been given by them without offering to them. And that's the meaning of verse 12 of chapter 3. This is a part of what Krishna said as Prajapati's instructions when he said Prajapati Uvacha, right? These are this continuation of that and what he said when he created the world. He says, when you have please the devas through your offering, deva yajna bhavitaha, when the devas are pleased by your offering, he says, vo dasyante, they will give ishtan bhogan, what you desire for. So they will literally fulfill all your desires. Ishtan bhogan, whatever you desire for will be fulfilled. In fact, one of our students from the 1970s, Swami students, we were talking to them, and he was telling when they were graduating, Swami had called them for an interview, and Swami was, you know, he was saying that that moment was so very special, because this was like a child who's going far away from home, and Swami wanted to give something, and Swami like constantly thinking, you know, what will I give them? Swami gave them pens, Swami gave them bags and whatever. You know, Swami was not satisfied with what he was giving. And finally, in this interaction that Swami had with these students, Swami said, you know, boys, you go and enjoy life well. Right? He was saying that surprisingly, Swami was saying, go and enjoy your life to the fullest. And in fact, Swami said, you know, you're all young, don't get married immediately. Enjoy life for some time and then you get married and get into all those responsibilities. Like Swami was saying that, you know, enjoy your life, but ensure that you don't do two things. Swami said, don't get into the habit of drinking and smoking, which are, of course, a representative example which Swami was giving, because Swami said that is going to spoil your health. But otherwise, there's nothing wrong in enjoying life. Lead a good life, you know, earn well, enjoy well. The reason I'm saying this is, you know, Swami was never against leading a full life. As Krishna says here, ishtan bhogan, the objects and pleasures that you desire, the gods will offer you, but do it through the process of righteous action and making it an offering to God and receiving the consequences as a form of consecrated prasadam, right? we might wonder, till now Krishna spoke so negatively about bhoga aishwaryas, right? I think in the second chapter somewhere he says that don't go after bhogas and pleasures of life. That now he's saying that have all your wishes fulfilled. The truth is, right now we all have desires, and how much ever we wish it, it will not go away. But is there a means by which we can pursue these desires to a certain extent and eventually become desireless? Right, that's the question. And that is the refrain in this entire place, right? When Arjuna says, I don't want to act because actions bind, the question is there any other means by which you can continue to do your actions and then become and go beyond the state of actionlessness? Similarly, is there a way by which we can pursue these desires, but it will eventually lead us to desirelessness? Let's say I am sick and I start taking medicines. What is the purpose behind me taking medicines when I am sick? In a sense, the purpose is so that I don't have to take medicines 2-3 days from now, right? The very purpose of taking medicines is so that my health becomes good enough that I won't need those medicines. So the goal is to be so healthy that I'm not going to be dependent on this. Similarly, our ultimate goal is to become desireless. There's no doubt about that. But right now, the reality is I do have desires. So can we follow this process that has been mentioned till now to pursue the desires so that eventually we will be free of these very desires? So when we follow the concept of yajna, we automatically follow a dharmic way of life, right? For the most part, this acknowledgement that what I enjoy is a gift of society, nature, and eventually all of this is representative of God. So when we acknowledge that what I enjoy is a gift of society, automatically we lead a dharmic life. We lead a religious life, right? Dharmic in that sense. Because today religion is out of our life because we don't think of God at all. We all enjoy saying that I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. We don't know what religious means, and we don't know what spiritual means either, right? So when we say a religious life, when we talk of a religious man, he's praying to the sun god, he's praying to the waters, he looks at the river and looks at her as a mother, he looks at the ocean and worships. So this entire religious life is meant to bring this attitude, right? And at the moment we start, looking at worship and prayers and trying to fill our lives with all of these things, there's always, as I said, a paddhati, a modus operandi, a certain form that you have to follow. And for that you will turn to the Vedas, and the Veda automatically mandates also a moral life, right? As I was just saying you, that you can never discount a moral dharmic life. So this idea of yajna, which Krishna has referred to as kamadhaka, the wish-fulfilling cow, involves all these steps: doing one's duty, making efforts as part of that duty, which doing that ensure that the actions conform to morally accepted norms, and offering one's effort to God as worship and as gratitude, and finally receive what comes as prasadam. So in this verse, Krishna goes on to say, taihi datan yo bhuk yo. The one who enjoys what they give, which is the deities, the one who enjoys whatever he receives from the deities, which is of course the devas, or which are represented by the devas represent nature, right? Those who enjoy what they give, apradayaibhyo, without making offerings to them, stena eva saha. Such a person is nothing but a thief. Stena means thief. So this balance that comes from mutual pleasure, you receive, feel grateful, and so what you do becomes your duty towards those who help you achieve. So this balance is what we are referring to. But if you don't do this, you are a thief. If you do not offer back to the gods, right? Again, this is a very cryptic message. It doesn't mean that the gods need your offering, or they get nourished by your offering, like sometimes mythology speaks about. that because the offerings were not made, the gods lost their power. It's not like that at all. This is all about the attitude with which you perform actions, attitude with which you carry on your life. So he says such a person becomes a thief. Who is a thief? Who wishes to take away something that the person doesn't deserve. I work hard all through my month to earn 50 grand, let's say. I mean, that's my salary. I work so hard and I earn 50,000 or 1 lakh or whatever is the salary. A thief comes one night, he breaks into the house and he takes it away. Right? So he is trying to enjoy a wealth or a resource which he has not deserved. Right? And if you were to consider it, a thief would never say thanks. A thief would never come and tell you, thank you for the money I looted from you. Right? So a thief takes what he or she wants, and there's no question of requesting or doing actions that make the person deserving. So there is a sense of entitlement that a thief always has. A thief thinks that the risk that one takes is good enough to justify the booty that one enjoys. Right? If you look at it, this is how we all lead our lives, right? We all lead lives like thieves. We think that we are entitled to whatever we can take from nature, right? So this entire section speaks about this very, very gentle balance which is there in nature and which can be preserved through this attitude of looking at, you know, personifying forces of nature. You have a feeling of having an interaction with them. They are blessing you. I am offering my gratitude, or I am offering my obeisance to them. You worship them. There's this very, very beautiful picture which was shared in social media sometime back. And they said that, you know, this represents the culture of Bharat, where I think it was somewhere north of India, one of the villages, Himalayan villages, where there was this village lady who was doing a worship, and this photographer takes a picture of her and goes and asks her, you know, what are you doing, sister? What is this that you're doing? And she said, I am worshipping the path, right? There is nothing there. There's a single person can walk through that path. And she was sitting there and she was offering flowers and giving aarti, and she's saying that, I'm worshipping the path. Because of this path, I get to go for my work every day. I get to collect my water. I get to send my children to school. So this is a tradition that we have in this village, that on this particular day, we all come and worship this path. Right? So even something as ordinary and simple as that has given a form of a deity, and you worship it, you thank it. And this leads to a balance, right? This is the balance which first of all, sustains this entire world. And as Krishna said, when actions are performed with this attitude, they do not bind you. They lead to antakarna shuddhi or chitta shuddhi, the purification of the mind, which will eventually make you eligible to receive the jnana. And that is what karma yoga is all about. So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode. I most humbly offer it at Swami's lotus feet. Thank you all for joining me. I hope to meet you all next week. It's 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all again next week. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.